Hi, this is Elena, and you're listening to Every Woman on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Every Woman is a feminist show that highlights the struggles, triumphs, and accomplishments of women and girls and the men who support them. Every Woman includes a rich intersection of female voices that represent a wide range of ethnicities, social and economic status, as well as political and spiritual beliefs, with the purpose to enact social, political, environmental, and economic change. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and the guests and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI staff, board, or management. Hello, everyone. This is Christina Frazier, and we are here with Every Woman, and we have Una Nowling, who is also co-hosting with me today.
Hello.
And we have Una's lovely wife, Fiona, at the board.
Hello.
And today we have three lovely ladies who are originally from Africa, but who live in Kansas City. We have Beverly Tanui. I said it right before. Tanui?
Yes.
Sorry about that. Naomi Chumba?
Got it.
And Genevieve Tioni.
Hello, everybody.
And today we were going to discuss women's lives from Kenya, from Africa, and talk a little bit about how life in Africa is the same or different from life in America for women. And so I wanted to start off by talking about Kenya, the country, and talk a little bit about where Kenya is on the African continent and what other countries surround Kenya.
Okay. Kenya is in the East Africa. We are along the Indian Ocean, and it's a country of about 45 million people. And we are a country of 42 tribes, even though they are suggesting of adding one tribe of the Indian accent to make 43 tribes. It's largely Christian country, about 80%, and the rest other tribes, other religions.
Yeah, also to add of that, Kenya is very diverse. Besides that, we have people from all over the world who have come to settle in Kenya, basically because of the beautiful weather that we have. We have a phenomenal weather. It's rainy, tropical, with plenty of animals, tourists from all over the world.
Being the east side of Africa, Kenya is surrounded by different countries. We have Somalia, we have Ethiopia to the north, we have a little portion of South Sudan, and then we have Uganda to the west side. And then to the south, we have Tanzania. But Kenya belongs to a larger Eastern African community, which also includes Burundi and Rwanda. And therefore, that has helped with trade and different commercial associations. And also, we share our language with most of these East African countries. We speak Swahili as our national official language, and that is a language that is also spoken in majorly in Tanzania and also some parts of Uganda.
Yeah. So tell me about life in Kenya when you were younger. If somebody was born in Kenya and they were a boy, a little boy or a little girl, what would the expectations be for them when they grow up? Would they be equal? Were there some differences? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, growing up in Kenya, culturally, in the past, there was more value with the boys. The Kenyan men were more regarded than the Kenyan women. The girls were primarily not taken to school for education, but just to grow up so that as soon as they attained the age of marriage, they were brought suitors to marry them, and in that the parents would get dowry, but the boys would be educated and were believed to be the future leaders of the community. Now, that has changed a lot.
Going back to the gender roles, there was and there's still distinct gender roles between the girls and the boys. And as Genevieve said, the boys were more regarded than the girls. And early 90s to the late 90s, there was a campaign for the girl child, even though right now it's switching because I think the girl child is coming up stronger. And currently in Kenya, they've started a campaign too for the boy child because they think they're focusing more on the girl child. And these are swift. The girls are becoming educated too as more as the boys.
So they had good success with the campaign
with
for
the
girls?
Campaign for the girl child. We have issues like the FGM, the early marriages. We had women who came out strong and were like, we cannot do this. We have to stop this. And because of that, the campaign was successful. And we are seeing a lot of girls get enrolled in schools and learn, but they still struggle a little bit.
Yeah. Just to expound on that, so you would find, like, growing up, being a girl, supposed to be kind of nurtured and mentored by a female, say the society, the female in the society would be responsible for nurturing girls and training them on the different roles that ladies would be required to engage in growing up. So you would find, like, most of us growing up, we were taught how to clean, to cook, how to take care of children. Our own siblings would take care of them. But for the boy child, we'd be taught other kind of these to divide the chores depending on their gender. Ability, like, or their gender. And you'd find most men would work in things that deal with, say, mechanics and farming and taking care of animals, especially in our society, because especially in our culture, we rear a lot of animals. And that is in our country part of the world, in our country.
The village.
Yes, the village.
Not the city.
Yes, not the city. But now in the city, you would find that there's becoming more a platform that is inclusive of both male and female. And in education, like Genevieve mentioned before, we used to have early marriages for girls. So they would be taken to school up to, say, here in US, you call them elementary school, but we call them primary school. And they would attain education up to a certain level. And beyond that, they are not able to put them to, like, a higher education, mm-hmm. like high school. Mm-hmm. So they'll send them off into marriages because they don't also want to invest in them. And they'll be later married off to somebody else.
I see.
Yes. So that was a challenge again. And then also, you find that this growing up, we always knew that we'll be married off one of these days, which when we get there, the boy child was given more priority in leadership and all those things because they're also looked at as being leaders of families.
Breadwinners.
Yes, mm-hmm. breadwinners. And they'll be giving more opportunities in leadership and in schoolwork and all those things. Yeah.
And to touch on the marriage, the girls being married off, that was seen as a source of income because there was a dowry price to be paid. So when a girl was married off to family, then they would get a source of income like cows or even cash. And most families would just marry off their children for that.
Mm-hmm. So would that be an arranged marriage then?
Sometimes.
In some communities,
It depends. Sometimes the parents will find you a suitor who's probably a friend of a friend and somebody who can pay more. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes these girls would just find their own boyfriends and get married and go with whom they like.
They choose.
And that was acceptable to choose. But with the dowry, it would seem like the family would have some interest in who their daughter married to get the more money, or
to some extent.
Especially looking at the different social classes. I mean, you'd prefer your child to get married to somebody who's rich.
More dowry.
But on top of that, if, for example, the child got married early, maybe beyond 18 to 26 and was more educated, now that meant more dowry. But the less education, then, you know,
the less dowry.
The less dowry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they would literally give you a list of my daughter has done graduate school,
exactly.
has a PhD. I'm just not going to give my daughter for just one cow.
Yes. Exactly.
You need the whole ranch.
Yes, we need the whole ranch. Yeah. Another thing, by the way, is religion.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which we cannot cut off out of our upbringing, because with religion, some religion in Africa actually allows men to marry more than one wife, mm-hmm. and they can marry as young as 9 years old.
Yep.
So you can imagine, like, in such areas, and you find these women are not able to access education, or they just don't have anything to do with their lives, then what is the next thing on the list is to get married, and somebody is willing to take you as a third or fourth wife. So,
and so would that, that would be in the traditional village, but not, but if most of the country is Christian, would that be accepted in the Christian world?
They claim to be Christian, some people, but they don't actually practice Christianity.
I see.
Yes.
Plus, but also, we allow polygamy in Kenya.
Yes. And polygamy is legal in Kenya, up to four wives.
Yeah, it's fading away now. The more people get educated, the more they learn the value of children, both male and female. They probably treat them the same. And the idea of marrying girl child, children at a younger age is fading away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do women, how do women in Kenya feel about polygamy? Do they feel that it's just the way it is? Or do most women think it's ridiculous?
I have aunties who are married into polygamy, and I see the struggle myself, and I've talked to some of my aunties and asked them how do they feel about it, and there's a line that's drawn. There's no way you're gonna treat both women the same. It's just human nature. You're gonna love one more than the other one, and my aunties, it's something actually close to my heart, don't feel that it's right. Mm-hmm. But circumstances just force them to do that, and they can't walk out of marriage because they don't have any other choice, according to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are they very, is it very important to them that their daughters have a choice, that they don't, that they didn't? Or are they unable to give them that choice at this time?
The younger generations are actually not buying the idea of polygamy, our generations. So I think they are excited that at least their daughters have a chance of not getting into polygamistic marriages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I also add that with polygamy, by the end of the day, in the event of death, there will be problems during funerals, mm-hmm. a division of property, mm-hmm. among other things. So it's hard when everybody will come and claim this one man who had not just one wife or two that they knew, but maybe there's a third one and a fourth one that nobody knew that they came.
Yeah.
So about the tribes, are you all from different tribes or just
same tribe?
Same tribe.
Yeah.
Yes, we decided to come here to start the show with people who we value the same one. And then as soon as we go along, we'll keep inviting others.
Other tribes.
To prepare us. We wanted to be on the same page at first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so did you know each other from Kenya, or did you meet here in Kansas City?
Here in Kansas City.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what brought you to Kansas City?
Good question.
I don't have time to answer that question.
I came to Kansas City because I got a job here. Mm-hmm. And I lived in New York and then St. Louis. And then I got a job in Kansas City. And I came to work in Kansas City. And then I had to bring my family later to join me when I've already settled here. That's how I ended up in Kansas City.
And myself, I first came to Minnesota or went to Minnesota. And after school, I was looking around for a place to settle and call it a home, and Kansas City was a choice for me because I had visited here probably 2-3 times and I fell in love with this city.
Oh, great.
Personally, I came to U.S. and the first state I was in was Tennessee, and that was where I did my graduate school. And then after that, I got engaged to this handsome man, and he brought me to Kansas City, got married.
Oh, great. Well, I think it's about time to take a break, but we will be back in just a minute.
An Innocence Commission, eliminating the statute of limitations on sexual assault of a child and raising the minimum wage are all on Representative Brandon Ellington's to-do list for this legislative session. To find out what else is on his list and the general craziness in Jefferson City, tune in to Jaws of Justice Radio Monday at 9 a.m. right after Democracy Now!
Saving the Clean Power Plan with Gretchen Waddell Barwick, a grassroots organizer with the Sierra Club, on the next episode of Eco Radio KC, airing at 6 p.m. Mondays here on KKFI Community Radio. Gretchen will talk about the upcoming listening session the EPA will have here in KC on February 21st.
And we're back. This is Every Woman, and we're here with Beverly, Naomi, and Genevieve, and they are three lovely ladies who live in Kansas City, but originally were born and raised in Kenya. And we're just discussing women's lives in Africa and also women's lives who come from Africa and what they feel life is like here in the United States for women. And so I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about your journey here and what brought you here and to the United States from Kenya. And how old were you when you came to the United States?
I came to U.S. in 2014. At the time, I was 28 years old. I had had opportunities back in Kenya. I was working. And so I just came to pursue my graduate school. And so from there to here, what has changed? The culture is different from Kenya and here. The food is different. There's so many things. And we will all get into that.
Yeah, I came here in 2005. I was fresh out of high school. And I wasn't actually exposed when I left Africa because I came straight from the village to the U.S.
To Minnesota?
Yeah, to Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
And at first it wasn't easy because it was in the middle of winter. I landed January 17th, I remember, and it was so cold. Oh. I didn't have a winter jacket. And I remember the person who picked me up looking at me and goes, "Ooh, you must have not looked and studied about the weather." And I was like, "I don't know." And I think the transition was easy for me because I was transitioning from a teenager into a young adult. And it's been good. Yes.
Yeah, I came here in 1997, January. I first landed in New York because I worked at the United Nations for 7 years. And my first town was New York City. There's nothing as bad as coming from Africa and coming to New York City and trying to figure out where was I.
In January, too?
In January, it was cold. I remember I was underdressed just like her. And the person who picked me just, luckily enough, had an extra jacket because they knew. They said, "Here's a jacket for you. It's very cold here," because the sun was bright, and I thought I could walk out just bright like that. So, yes, I worked in New York City, and there was a lot of cultural stuff that I saw that I could not believe that I was in this country, and a lot of opportunities. I went to school there, and then I went to college at St. John's University, and then I relocated to St. Louis, Missouri. I stayed there, got married, and then my husband and I and the children, we moved to Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were some when you first got to the United States, what were some things that were different as far as the way women, what you noticed that was different about women and how women were treated from Kenya as opposed to being in the United States? Like, what did you notice the first
thing? The biggest shock was the dress code, the way we dress in Africa and the way they dress here. It's totally different. There's a way we dress in Africa. We cover up from neck to all the way to the bottom. We, you know, mm-hmm. That's traditionally. And when I walked around the New York City and looked around, it was interesting to see the dress code. Exactly. So one of the things was the dress code that took me. I was like, wow, it's freedom. This is freedom, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was still in my 20s and I tried to dress like an American too, once in a while. So we change, but you know, as you grow older, you still have your traditions to keep. You have to dress a certain way. So the way we dress here in America is not the way probably I'll dress in Africa.
Yeah. Mine, and I still remember to date, was during class break. And people went outside, and everybody was walking outside to the door, and I realized that they were actually going to smoke. And I saw so many girls smoke. Where I came from, Kenya, girls rarely barely smoke. And I remember me and my friends sitting down and talking about it, and I was like, wow, this freedom in this country, you can do what you want to do. So that was a major thing that I noticed for me. Yeah.
For me, I think I love watching news a lot. Yeah, and what I noticed the most in the difference between Kenya and here is the involvement of women, the voice of the women in this country. Mm-hmm. We have, in this country, like, there's so many women who have pursued their political careers, and they are vocal, and you have so many women who are owning businesses and selling products, their own products, actually. There's, like, so much opportunities for women in this country, mm-hmm. and also with education, because I teach. And I see so many girls in school and pursuing very courses that would not really be pursued by women back in my country, things like engineering and complex things, you know, in school, even though right now we have more women getting involved with these engineering courses, and it's changing back in Kenya. So that was the major difference I noticed, like the voice of the women, the space of the women, the leadership roles in women in this country as opposed to back in my country.
Yeah. Was there a backlash? It seems like things changed pretty quickly in Kenya. Was there a backlash for trying to educate girls and lift up girls? Or was it just really smooth? It just started and it happened?
Oh, no.
It hasn't been smooth.
No, yeah. We had people like Wangari Maathai. Mm-hmm. You heard about her, the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner. Mm-hmm. She was really advocating for peace, democracy, and sustainable development in Kenya, mm-hmm. and voicing out the different women rights issues. Mm-hmm. And we also had many women coming out in public to talk about the women, the space of the women in the society. And because there was actually an increase of gender-based violence or domestic violence and other things like putting women down and not really making them a priority, mm-hmm. in things to do with like education, political arena, and all those things. And therefore, you found that many women were voicing out and saying, hey, we have a place in this society. We need to be heard. And we saw many women getting into courses like law, medicine, and different places so that their voice can be heard from up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and also to add on top of that, we've had organizations, especially from the U.S. or worldwide, that have educated women, and those who've gotten scholarships and opportunities, mm-hmm. have taken back what they've learned back to Africa, mm-hmm. and made sure they empowered the women into being who they are. For example, we have now women in political positions, in human rights positions, mm-hmm. and everywhere where there was, it was male dominated, mm-hmm. at least the women have infiltrated into the system and system. Are vocaling their voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to add on that, we know that country has, Africa has all these countries, and this kind of like learning from other countries in Africa, like Rwanda. Rwanda is one of the countries in Africa that really fights a lot for the women's rights. And I think the other countries like Kenya and all the others, they're trying to learn from them and copy them and just put the woman forward as far as culture is concerned, as far as all this education and anything that's pertaining the woman.
We also have a president who is the only female president. Salif Jones from Liberia. So yeah. It's progress of women is going on very well.
Now, I read that Kenya had a new constitution in 2010 that was much more focused on human rights, mm-hmm. and progressive policies. Could you describe what sort of difference that political change made for the lives of women?
Currently, right now, in the Kenyan, especially political sphere, we have women representatives from every county, and that came from the constitution that was amended. Now, a long time ago, we used to have like 8 provinces and only have like a member of parliament from these provinces. But right now, we have 47 different counties. And in those counties, we have, apart from the other leadership positions that are there in the county, which is governor, senator, and youth rep and all the other leadership positions, there's actually a specific leadership position for women representative in every county. And then also, coming to the business sector, the economic part is that in Kenya right now, if you're in a company and you're offering tenders, 30% of your tender has to go to women, youth, and people with disabilities. So there's no way you would conclude a tendering process in any company if you had not given 30% to that minority group, yes, in Kenya.
But I read, too, as well, that maybe the progress hasn't been as good in the country. I read a statistic that said about 80% of the women outside of the cities are engaged in farming, but only 1% actually own the farms or own the farmland. Has there been any recent progress?
That is correct. According to the 2010 Constitution, they passed, back in the beginning, the family's land belonged to the boys. It did not belong to the girls. But the Constitution actually wanted to include the women. So it's something that it's been passed, but it's not practiced yet. So we hope that as we go on, as the years pass by, they will actually give the land to the women and they will own it so that they can continue the farming, as you've asked.
Just the way Naomi has said, right now, a family cannot just say, okay, my piece of land is for the boys alone. We as girls too have a right in that. We have a share. And once we have a share, then we can use that land productively for the benefit of the family. So it is not a man's world anymore.
Mm-hmm. Plus also, just to add to that, that right now in Kenya, women have really been so much empowered. And also, it's not just about empowering the woman, it's also empowering the society to look differently at these women, because we can all be empowered but not still stand out. So in the society right now, we have different companies or even organizations, and even banks are coming in to empower women even financially, because they always say that where there's money, there's power. You are only heard when you have a lot of money. Sometimes they say that. I don't know how that is true, though.
It's true.
But right now they're giving loans to women.
Yep.
We have specific banks that are giving loans to women. We also have other types of banking that is called table banking. So we kind of pool our resources together. And then, say, for example, each one of us chips like $1,000, if we're able to, every month. And then we give that to UNER this month, and then you decide what you want to do for your business with that money, and then the next month would be Kristen. So they've come up with different ways to finance the ideas of women, so that we are just not in the farms, so that we are just not working in our own homesteads, but we are going out there to start businesses to make sure that our dreams are true, they're a reality. Yeah.
And also to add on top of that, like Beverly has said, besides this table banking, we have the social media. A lot of women have used the social media to enhance their businesses and social progress and human rights issues, because now you cannot do something that is not going into the social media. If you have business, you throw it out there. If there's a violation of a woman by anybody, by the government, by individuals, you put it out there and then it goes out. So a lot, the social media has really helped a lot.
Greatly helped. Yeah.
And even here in US, you hear the Me Too campaign.
Yes.
Because women are voicing out in their places of work if they feel they are treated less or harassed at work just because of their physique or how their gender. So with regards to that, I think we are living in a society right now that everybody is enlightened in a way and is able to voice out, even if not directly to the media, which would speak out loud for them. But if you just voice it out through the social media, at least you have somebody who's willing to listen.
So are you saying that the Me Too movement has affected women in Kenya, and you're saying that how has it affected women in Kenya? What if something happens to a woman, she at least can go on social media? Is that what you mean?
That's a good question, because right now With U.S. speaking out, having these influential women, even in the media and like theater, and they are voicing out their experiences and how they've been harassed here in the place of work, you know, U.S. has a major influence in so many countries. When U.S. says something, many countries incline in that direction as well. So when we see many influential women up there voicing out their concerns, it has impacted Africa in general, not just Kenya, Africa in general, that we believe that even if we can also stand in that campaign and speak out for those women who cannot speak for themselves, because many women are being harassed at work and they don't have a channel to take it out because fear of losing a job.
I was going to say, before the Me Too campaign, we had a campaign in Kenya in 2016, which was hashtag My Dress, My Choice, because women were going out to the streets and they were being undressed by men who did not like how they dressed. Let's say probably
they were being undressed?
Yes, like stripped naked in front of the streets. So people came out and started doing the campaign, My Dress Code. Was it My Dress Code, My Choice?
Yes.
Yeah, My Dress, My Choice.
My Dress, My Choice. And actually that kind of strengthened the women to a point that women could go out there and just choose how to dress without nobody actually saying anything or anything being done to them.
So what type of dress were some men disapproving of?
Miniskirts and maybe tight pants. I remember looking at some of the videos. It wasn't like
that bad.
So the punishment for dressing to not wearing a miniskirt would be to make you naked? That doesn't make sense to me, to take your clothes off.
According to the thinking that these guys had was, okay, you came out here like this, you wanted to be naked, so we are going to just go ahead and make you naked. It was a twisted kind of thinking that these guys thought. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also to add on top of that is, like Beverly and Omi have said, most of the Kenyan culture or African culture, they tend to copy the West. Mm-hmm. The way you dress, the way you act, the way you eat, we kind of look up to the West for some of these things. For example, Lupita Nyong'o, celebrity, she's an actor. Mm-hmm. She was in the Me Too movement. She was a victim of
sexual harassment.
Yeah, sexual harassment. So we look at that, and her voice represents us, that we can also be like her. We can talk like her and act like her. So when the Western people come to our country, and the way the freedom of, like, the dress code here, the way you dress, the way you want, Africa is bound by, culturally, traditionally, that a woman should somehow
be covered.
Yeah,
torn in between.
Yeah, should be covered up to the knee or dress in a certain way. So when these young girls start copying the Western culture, then it clashes. Well, the Western culture clashes with the traditional. And then now that's when there's a problem. But some of these men who are stripping the women, they really don't mean it. It's because most of them either were rejected by that woman and then they're getting back to them. So it's not genuine that they didn't like the dress. It's getting back at them because they cannot get to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And in such a society, like if we can talk mostly about Kenya because we are from Kenya, but I can just imagine other countries in Africa where religion plays a major role in how people dress. I would say in Kenya we are more contemporary somehow than it is with so many other countries in Africa. Now, if you go to the capital city of Kenya, which is Nairobi, you'd literally think you're somewhere in US because people are so open-minded. Mm-hmm. People dress in a very in a way that just shows their freedom. You wake up in the morning, however you choose to dress, you dress appropriately. Mm-hmm. Going to office, there's a way you dress to go to work. Going for social events, there's a way people dress to go to those social events. So there's kind of like a freedom in the capital city. And you would be surprised that some people who live in Nairobi, when they go back to their villages, they have to change the way they dress. Otherwise, they would not fit in their own village, because people will be looking at them like, you're so spoiled. You have actually embraced a different culture from what you are raised to adopt or live or portray. And which is a good thing if people are exposed to different cultures, because that enables you to understand people and accept them how they are and why they want to do the things they want to do.
Yes.
Well, I think that there's a little bit of that still in the United States. I mean, the way people dress are sometimes in the city, and if you have family members that live in the country, you do typically tone it down a little bit. So yes. that might be a universal thing.
Because honestly, I can't go home with a miniskirt.
Yeah.
My parents will tell me to take the next bus and go back.
Yes. Most of our friends are old school. Most of our families are old school. They are still very traditional. Maybe our children are going to change the way we dress, and it depends either we are brought up in the city or brought up in the village. Yes. So it depends where you go. You can wear the miniskirt to the city, but when going to the village, you change because then you're going to a different, it's like the Mormons, the way they dress with long dresses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. How does Christianity play into just the way women are empowered or how women are viewed in Kenya? Because there's a traditional, but then also the type of Christianity is sort of evangelical. Is that correct?
Yes.
I think Christianity in general in Kenya, most women, if there's a place they go for comfort, it's Christianity. Most of the things they do is based on the church. For example, even no matter what you're going through financially, economically, and culturally, there's one place that you go to, it is the church. Everybody goes to church, whether you're rich, you're poor, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's the comfort zone for a lot of women in Africa, and that's where we are bound.
And I want to make sure that African women take the Bible the way it is, the way it's written there, they take it like that. When you go to the country, you'll find that women, it's so rare for those women to dress in pants because somewhere in the Bible says they should not do that, and that's how they perceive the Bible. Or maybe where it says that the man should be left to be the leader of the family, they actually take that literally and leave everything for the man to make the last decisions, the man to have a say of everything that goes on in the house. So Christianity actually in Africa, it plays, not in Africa, but basically in Kenya, it plays a lot. It does affect the families. Like Jennifer said, the women, they go to church basically for comfort and
hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you find like even though we ascribe leadership and provision role for male, we find that more women are the ones who are entirely responsible for raising their own children in Africa today. Like, and I'm not saying that men have absconded their job of doing this, but you just find like women, if you speak to different women, their experiences are, or even women here in US who are raised back in Kenya, they will tell you that it's their mom that worked hard to get them to wherever they are today. And with that being said, where does the church come in? Like Genevieve said, it's a place that people run to, because in church you will find encouragement, you will find that hope, you will find a place where you belong, and somebody cares about your needs. But that's not entirely what happens in Kenya as well when it comes to Christianity, because there's how Christianity is perceived in the villages, and then there's how Christianity is perceived in the cities.
Yes.
That's different. Now, in the cities, people dress even pants to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
People even dress short dresses and skirts to go to church, and that's not an issue, because the cities in Kenya are more westernized. Mm-hmm. Than the country areas in Kenya. So, like for me, I used to go to church in Nairobi, and I never used to have to think about if my dressing will offend somebody else. But in the village, you'd have to really think about that. Mm-hmm. You'd really always have to dress thinking, where am I going? Who will be around me? And all those things. And then you're also finding like they've used also the church platform to empower women, because you find most of these organizations and institutions that are inclined into women rights have a way of getting women who are in church. It's easy to congregate them in a church and to share this information with them. You have different training programs that are carried out by different sponsors from around the world, and the major place they target is churches, because you will find a high population of women in churches actually. So it's a good thing as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add to what Beverly has just said, that my stories is sometimes you dress up and ready to go to church, and then your mother will tell you, are you sure you're going to wear that to church? Can you please go and change and go change?
So we are not going to the same church.
We are not going to the same church. Yes. So our parents will dictate what we wear to church versus yes. what we want.
Yes. Yeah.
It brings up an interesting point, excuse me, that of the problem of female genital mutilation, or FGM, mm-hmm. because many people in America, they connect that for some reason with Islam. That it must be only those awful, terrible, evil Muslims over there that are doing it. Mm-hmm. But it's a problem even in countries where the majority is Christian, as it turns out, such as Kenya. I understand that that practice is banned in the country, but it is dying out, even though I think the statistics say about 1 in 4 women have undergone the procedure. Is mm-hmm. there anything you can talk about with progress on that front?
That question you asked is close to home for me, because my mom underwent the FGM, and I remember when I was growing up, there was a campaign against it. The government wanted to stop it, and I went to my mom and I asked her, what was the point? Why did you have to go through it? And I remember I was in 8th grade, and I was curious, and I remember asking, and I was like, can I myself go through it? Because my mom was my god. I looked up to her. She's a very strong woman.
And you, wanted to go through it?
Yes. When I saw my mom, the way she was strong, and she kept actually saying she went through it, I asked her, and I was like, will it make me to be like you? Will it make me to be hardworking, to be successful like you? And she had high standard morals. And my mom actually started teaching me through it and was like, this is a culture that has been banned and it's not okay, it's not advisable. And I told her to explain to me how painful it was, because they said it wasn't something pretty. And she said actually it was more painful than a birthing a baby. And the cultures that practice FGM, they saw as a way of controlling a woman, because they thought that that will make a woman not to engage in prostitution or to have low morals. So I read a lot on it, and I came to realize it's actually a culture that is twisted. People need to understand that it has nothing to do with morals. It doesn't help at all. So the FGM is still low. The only party in Kenya that's still practiced is North Kenya. Mm-hmm. The tribes that are along North Kenya, they still do practice it. But to the south and other parts of Kenya, it's almost gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, if you think about FGM, the campaign against it even became part of what we learn in school. It was actually incorporated into our education system, that you would literally learn about it in school and know the effects of it, like how negative that is. It's because they were tying it into part of the culture, which is a rite of passage.
Mm-hmm.
The men in our society go through circumcision as a rite of passage, which means they have transitioned from being kids to adulthood. They were doing the same for women, so that they transitioned from being just young girls into women who are ready to bear children and all those things and take up responsibilities in the society. Now, I personally, if you ask me today, what is the relationship between mutilating somebody's reproductive parts with their responsibility in the society? I don't see any connection. So that's why it was really banned. If you want to train me to become a responsible woman, take me to school. Mm-hmm. And they say this in Kenya, educate a boy, you've educated one person. Educate a woman, you've educated a whole society.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Because that's how we empower women in Kenya. And empowering came about by letting us know that this is not a social norm. FGM is not a social norm. You're actually making people go through stress.
Yes.
You're actually making people scared. I would imagine what it would have been for Naomi. Just think about it. Mm-hmm. Is this something that I have to go through?
Yeah.
Then I'd rather not grow up.
Mm-hmm. So was this an old tradition or was this a newer tradition? Because it doesn't seem like it would be something from the old days.
It's not old days. Some people actually still practice it, but they hide it because it's illegal. You'll get into the
wrong side,
of the law if you do practice it. And it's just the exposure. If people are educated, like Beverly has said, it doesn't cause any change. It doesn't really help. But the society is still, the society that still practices it thinks actually it does bring something, but it does not. So there are some people that actually still do practice it.
So I guess my question is, traditionally, as a rite of passage, was FGM a part of that? Or was that something that started 50 years ago, 75 years ago? Or was it always practiced?
I think it was always practiced. Because our great-grandparents and, you know, up to the generation of Naomi's mom, who's young, did it out of choice. And also, I want to mention that it was also out of peer pressure. When you have like 20 girls in the village, they'll talk to each other and they all agree we are going to do it. Because they believe that there was a situation where if you don't get to go through FGM, then you don't get a husband. And none of them wanted to be left behind. So they incited each other, and these men would actually come and pick only girls who undergone FGM. And the girls who did not undergo FGM did not get sweethearts or husbands. So they put pressure on themselves to undergo the process, which was painfully. But in the long run, we have statistically some of them passed away during that. It that led process. To death and death. So the government has really been tough on FGM, has cracked it down. And now they've even, I was home in December, and most of the people who were performing the surgical FGM
procedure
have now turned into educators, going back to the village and telling people, let's stop it. We have to stop this. So it's changing.
Yeah. I mean, there are practices that we still carry along because they help to shape a society, but there are practices that are entirely relevant to a society like FGM because not just of the brutality in it, but also the health impact it has on these women. Because I believe that it's actually the public health that spoke out against it, because these women are really predisposed to diverse infections because of undergoing such procedures in an unsterile environment, and they don't even have medical access in such in such areas where they practice this FGM, and therefore because of the health risks, I think it would be one of the things that the campaign needs to go on and not assume that the society has just accepted it as not being a norm just because it's not being practiced for most part. Yeah.
Well, just to change the tone a little bit, what? How do you, now that you've been living in America for some time, what is your perspective on the political, you know, what's been going on politically for women, and especially in last year, 2017.
In the U.S. or in Kenya?
Here in U.S.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
In the U.S.?
Yeah, from your perspective, you know, coming from, because it sounds like Kenya is very progressive and moving things along quickly, and there's a problem, and it sounds like that people are solving it, and then it's a little, seems like it might be a little slower here. What's your perspective?
That's a sore topic.
You can do it, Naomi.
Well, we've been seeing a lot going on the political arena here, given the fact that the president himself wasn't helping during the 2016 elections, saying a lot of things that were not
negative,
really productive as far as the women were concerned. So my view on that is, at least the women here, they have support. They come out in large numbers and they speak against what is being spoken against them. And I think it was about last month, there was a rally that was held. I think it was in Washington where the large number of women came out and they were speaking against that this is wrong.
The Women's March.
The Women's March.
Yeah,
we also had
one in Lawrence.
20th January.
Yes, the Women's March. And I don't know. I really don't know, because this is the first world country. You would think things would be better for you guys. But then again, when you see from another side, it's like people are not taking women seriously. So maybe Beverly helped me on this.
Because I like to watch news a lot.
Yes.
Let me say this. We in the political sphere in this country, a lot is changing right before our eyes. U.S. is a big voice in the whole world. It really is. I hope people in U.S. know that. Mm-hmm. That the countries around the world tend to bend the way U.S. is bending, in a way. The reason why we had more women being empowered in Africa is because U.S. has a voice about it. U.S. could come to a country and say, we don't like the way you're treating women in this country. This needs to stop. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't stop, we'll stop this funding. They attach it always to something. And that created a discipline in which a country would kind of incline themselves to that, knowing that because we need U.S. to have a voice in our country to shape the way things happen in our country, would be. But we still ask ourselves this question today, is U.S. still a voice today? In the way things are going on
and
in this country
changing.
Right now. And it's changing very fast. To an extent whereby, is it okay to just have alternative facts, the way it said? Or is it just okay to allow some things to appear normal when they are not supposed to be normal, even in a place where you expect there to be a sound voice that says, let's call white white and black black. Let's separate two things and treat them as they are and not try to jumble up and convince the society it's not what you're looking at, you know? And it's a little bit confusing to the society out there, especially from the impact of the political atmosphere right now in U.S. It's a little bit confusing out there. But luckily enough, in U.S., women have a voice. And they are not stopping to talk. We see the media using that as a platform to address these different issues. We have not seen any neglect going on in an extent that now nobody's no longer talking about anything. Nobody's raising any concerns. We have women who are speaking out, and it's a good thing. And we ask that those women to continue voicing their concerns so that the society will hear them out, no matter how long it takes.
It takes.
Yes.
But it's good to note, too, that whatever struggles that women are facing here in the U.S., we are facing the same all over the world.
Yes.
The glass ceiling, being the second-class citizens and having the men to the first-class citizens, it's the same struggle.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Regardless of any religious affiliation, culture, by the end of the day, a woman is a woman, and they're the ones who probably carry
the heaviest burden.
But what worries me a lot is, what are we passing down to the next generation? How are these women defining themselves in a society which does not care about their voice, and they always have to take the streets and speak out?
Yes.
Why can't they just speak out in their offices and they are heard? Why can't they just speak out in their schools and they are heard? Why does it always have to be on the streets for them to be heard? So what are we passing down to our generations? If we get girl children, will we be able to tell them, hey, we have laid a foundation for you guys that you don't have to struggle to be heard in this society? You know, when will it stop that men will just not think of women as sex objects in their jobs, that promotion is not attached to sexual harassment and things like that? This needs to stop. It needs to be called out and addressed. And people really, we need to see a public show of what happens to such people so that it's not condoned in our society.
I think it's great that you're talking about that in Kenya, the pendulum swinging back to now it's time to lift up the boys, because I really believe it's this toxic masculinity that creates some of these issues. And and I think boys need to understand their masculinity in a different way that's not about domination and about, you know, putting others down and things like that. And I think that, that when that happens, which is great that that sounds like that in Kenya, that's going to happen. And so I think that that's really going to make change. So what a fascinating talk. I learned so much. And Genevieve, you are somebody who is a volunteer here at KKFI.
Yes.
And you also have some things coming up. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. This is actually going to be my home in the future. So I will be doing African radio shows starting here, and I'll be having different guests talk about different issues, not just women, children, but also economy, politics, and culture. And also, not the most important, is for the Americans to hear the Kenyan music, African music, and the way we do things. We'll also use the forum to announce things that are coming up in the community and connect them with the first world and the what they call third world. Now we are first world. So, and we will have great guests like Naomi and Beverly and many others that are out there that will be coming to talk on many other issues. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm getting ready to get there, and I appreciate that.
Do they have a time slot for your show yet?
Not yet. I'm still talking with the manager. And once I'm ready, I'll let them know. Then we'll talk about it.
That's great. Yeah, I think a lot of people, especially people in the Midwest, I think don't know enough about Africa. Mm-hmm. And what a diverse and beautiful and interesting country mm-hmm. Africa is. So I think that would be great. And we are going to close the show with a song by somebody, one of your favorite artists?
Yes, Emmy Kosgei. Yes. We all love her. We can't wait to hear and dance for you guys right here.
Okay, so stay tuned for some music. And then after that, we will have Urban Connections with Donna Wolf. And then guess who's coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson. Christina, you have any final words?
Listen to the song is in is also in English. And it has some really beautiful words, so and a beautiful beat. So listen.